From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
America's principles are on trial today. Governor Bush wants to wash his hands and step away from responsibility.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson meets with Shaka Sankofa Gary Graham in Texas as his execution is one day away. Meanwhile, a top Texas state senator calls for a rare public hearing of the parole board as they decide Graham's fate. Also, the wrongful death suit against the government for the Waco raid opens in Texas. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A top Texas state senator has asked the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles to hold a public hearing on the fate of condemned prisoner Gary Graham. In a letter obtained by the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Senator Rodney Ellis asked Board Chair Gerald Garrett for a rare full hearing of the 18-member board on Graham's case. Ellis is president pro tem of the Texas Senate and serves as the state's top executive when the governor and lieutenant governor are out of state. Graham is scheduled to die Thursday, 6 o'clock, Texas time. We'll have more on that story later in the program. This news from Florida: a death row prisoner is still alive in Florida following a last-minute stay of execution. Thomas Provenzano's reprieve from a federal appeals court in Atlanta came 10 minutes before his scheduled date with death yesterday. Provenzano was already strapped to a gurney and had needles in his arms when word of the stay arrived. Provenzano had lost appeals to the Florida Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court. Florida Governor Jeb Bush, George Bush's brother, had denied a clemency petition. The appeal to the Atlanta court was a long shot. The court hasn't stayed a Florida execution in several years. The three-judge panel didn't give a reason for its decision and didn't say when the stay would expire. The 50-year-old convict was condemned for fatally shooting a bailiff in an Orlando courtroom in 1984. Authorities say Provenzano had delusions of being Jesus Christ. With strong bipartisan support, the Senate voted yesterday to make hate attacks on gays a federal crime. The vote was an unexpectedly wide 57-42 and was the first time either House of Congress backed protection of gays in a roll call vote that could have political consequences. The Senate passed a similar measure last year, quietly and unanimous consent, only to see it killed in a House-Senate conference. The bill passed yesterday would expand federal jurisdiction for crimes based on race, religion, and national origin, and would also add sex and handicap status to the categories covered, as well as sexual orientation. But while the issue never came up openly in debate, senators on both sides agreed the sexual orientation issue was the question that made the bill a close call. This news from Los Angeles. A union representing 9,300 police officers plans demonstrations during the Democratic National Convention in August, a potential embarrassment in a city dealing with a police corruption scandal and a riot by hundreds of sports fans. The Los Angeles Police Protective League says members are frustrated with contract negotiations and upset about being excluded from federal efforts to implement reforms stemming from the scandal. The union applied for a demonstration permit yesterday, a day after television images of rioting Los Angeles Lakers fans were beamed nationwide. A group of undocumented Mexican and Guatemalan workers will get their day in court. The 27 women claim they were strip-searched, groped, and labeled with slurs at the Phoenix company where they worked. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is suing Quality Art on behalf of the women. EEOC Chair Ida Castro says undocumented workers are among the most vulnerable victims of workplace discrimination. That's because many employers don't realize the workers are also protected under the Civil Rights Act. The women claim they were strip searched after being accused of stealing money. This in Phoenix, Arizona. The world's largest water company, Vivendi, is paying $30 billion to acquire Seagram Corporation, owner of Universal Movie and Music Studios. The transatlantic merger announced yesterday will create Vivendi Universal, a Paris-based media conglomerate and a pair with global players like AOL, Time Warner, and Viacom. It also completes the transformation of Seagram from distiller to media player, providing distribution channels for its films and music. Seagram's liquor business, built up over three generations in the Bronfman family, will be sold off. The new conglomerate will also include Canal Plus, a major European cable TV company already half-owned by Vivendi. The leader of gunmen holding Fiji's former prime minister and other lawmakers hostage in parliament said today he hopes to reach an accord with the military this week. Rebel leader George Speight's demand that political power be wrested from Fiji's ethnic Indian minority had been watered down Monday when he said he'd be willing to allow a few Indians in the interim government. Speight led the May 19th armed takeover of parliament. He said his goal was to restore dignity to the ethnic Fijian majority. The rebels and the military, which imposed martial law 10 days after the raid, held negotiations for the fourth straight day today on forming an interim regime. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The $675 million wrongful death case against the government over the 1993 raid on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, opened yesterday. The suit consolidates nine civil cases filed by relatives and survivors of the government raid that resulted in the deaths of about 80 people, including at least 20 children. The trial is expected to last about a month. It'll deal with four issues: whether alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agents used excessive force in the initial raid, whether government agents helped cause the fires that destroyed the compound, whether the government was negligent by withholding firefighting equipment, and whether using tanks to push into the compound deviated from a plan approved by Attorney General Janet Reno. Lawyers for the Branch Davidians yesterday opened their case, displaying pictures of 15 of the children killed in the raid. As the images were scrolled, lead attorney Michael Cadell recited their names one by one. With each image recited, said, "Never fired a gun, never broke the law, never hurt anyone." In a significant move yesterday, the judge excluded testimony from three FBI negotiators who said tanks should not have been used to end the siege. The judge agreed with government lawyers who say the negotiators' testimony and communications fell under a privilege that shields the federal government from liability, even if its agents' actions prove negligent. It's designed to give federal officials the ability to act without the fear of being sued. We go now to Lee Hancock, who is outside the courthouse in Waco, Texas. She's a reporter for the Dallas Morning News, who's covered Waco from the beginning and broken a number of stories, including the government's use of pyrotechnic gas on the compound that led to a congressional investigation. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lee Hancock.
Thank you for having me.
Describe the scene in the courtroom as the trial opened yesterday.
Well, it was a very full spectators area. There are about a dozen surviving Branch Davidians who have come to watch the proceedings, as well as families of several of the SEC members who died in the 1993 fire. Additionally, there are as many as 13, 14 government attorneys who are sitting back in the spectator seats because they have brought a very large contingent from Washington to help defend this very, very complex case. There are also probably two dozen reporters who have been covering this from around the country, including some from abroad, because this incident has, has continued to draw attention on Waco in the 7 years since it occurred.
What do you think will be the key arguments of the lawyers representing the survivors and relatives of those who died?
Well, one of the very first things that they tried to do yesterday, and certainly a theme that they will be striking as the trial goes on, they are trying to humanize the members of the Branch Davidian group. They are trying to introduce them to this jury of six Central Texas residents and one alternate is the people next door, people with a different set of religious values, but people who had kids, who had lives, who were just like anyone else in this area. For the entire 51-day siege in 1993, the world was introduced to the Branch Davidians as an apocalyptic sect who had prepared for war, who had armed themselves heavily, and were in blind devotion to their leader and self-proclaimed Messiah, David Koresh. The lawyers for the plaintiffs very, very quickly yesterday said they were not there to defend David Koresh, and they were not going to excuse the actions of Mr. Koresh and some of his followers who fired on ATF agents when they came in 1993 trying to serve arrest and search warrants on the Davidians' home. That's what, of course, sparked the standoff with federal authorities. They're also saying they are not going to defend what may be a few Davidians who may have set some of the fires at the end of the siege that ended the standoff. Now, on the other hand, the government is trying to do exactly the opposite. In an opening statement that was very reminiscent of the 1994 criminal trial in which eight surviving Branch Davidians were convicted of manslaughter and weapons charges in connection with the siege and the deaths of the ATF agents. The federal lawyers continually talked about the Davidians and David Koresh, the Davidians and their messianic apocalyptic leader, the Davidians and their leader's message that they had to prepare for war, they had to prepare for a war with the government, and that war with the government was going to take place on their property. So both sides are trying very hard to argue to the jury those very conflicting views of this group and what they were about. One other interesting thing about yesterday's development with the judges ruling on the negotiations issue, that is a preliminary ruling. What it tells the lawyers on both sides, although it is a significant first step for the government, the lawyers on both sides now must approach the judge before they begin to get in any kind of evidence or testimony that might lead to a discussion of what the negotiators were trying to warn the FBI about what might happen if they sent tanks and tear gas into the building. The judge also indicated at the bench, however, both sides said, that he may be willing to put in a limited amount of testimony from the FBI's negotiators, a limited amount of information and documents going to the issue of how much the FBI's commanders in Waco were warned about the violence that might result from sending tanks to begin dismantling the building. On that issue, the judge said he might be inclined to introduce the evidence. Additionally, to get the agreement from the judge that the plaintiffs would have to get permission before exploring that line of evidence, the government agreed that it will not try to argue to jurors that the Davidians who stayed inside and did not surrender were contributorily negligent, that they should have come out, and simply by not coming out, they should also be found at least partially negligent for the deaths that resulted. So that ruling yesterday came at a cost, and it was, you know, kind of a split decision for both sides. I think that's a lot of what we're going to be seeing as we go through what has been constructed as some fairly narrow legal issues on a very complex incident.
We're talking to Lee Hancock, reporter with the Dallas Morning News, who has broken a number of stories in Waco, including the government's use of pyrotechnic gas on the compound. Let's go back to that, the use of this gas. How did you discover it?
Well, the first hint that there might be something different, that, you know, there might be a different story than that the government had given us at that time, it was for more than 6 years, came in some very, very short legal filings that were made by the Texas Department of Public Safety. If you remember, the Texas Department of Public Safety and their chief investigators, the Texas Rangers, were asked to come in during the standoff to help investigate any crimes that might have resulted from what was going on in Waco. And they were asked to keep custody of evidence in the case. There were some questions that arose about some of that evidence, about photographs that had been taken of canisters that appeared to have been fired at the compound. In looking at those pleadings, you know, we began asking questions. We went to some military experts who looked at these devices and said one of the photographs appeared to be that of a device called an M651 pyrotechnic tear gas round. Now, to explain, it is not an incendiary round. It is not designed to start a fire, but it is the type of device that is fired, and it expels its tear gas by burning. It's capable of starting fires. Janet Reno, when she approved the use of gas to try to get the sect out in 1993, expressly forbade the FBI from using anything capable of sparking fires, any kind of pyrotechnic devices. And from the very beginning after the fire, the FBI spokesman came out and insisted that only non-pyrotechnic gas had been used. After we got a military expert who said, yes, that looked like a spent pyrotechnic gas device, one of the FBI senior officials who had been in Washington, who had been heavily involved in the planning for this operation, just said flatly, absolutely, several of those devices were used. And that opened the question of whether the FBI's gassing, whether some of the devices they have used may have contributed to the fire. The FBI and the government have said they were used only on a limited basis. They were not fired directly into the compound. But lawyers for the Davidians say they have evidence, and they will argue that some of the devices were fired directly into the compound. The FBI fired some 400 tear gas grenades. They ran out of the type of devices that could be used without the danger of fire. Their story to the jury is going to be the FBI was scrambling. They were almost out of gas, and just before the fire broke out, they fired some of the devices into some of the areas where the fires were seen appearing within minutes.
Lee Hancock, for listeners around the country who may not even know exactly where Waco is, can you describe what the feeling is in the town right now as this really unprecedented lawsuit and trial is taking place?
Well, Waco, which is a community between Austin and Dallas, about 100 miles from each in central Texas, is a town that feels like they have been burdened with this tragedy for the past 7 years. Before the trial, residents who were asked by reporters, there were a number of stories about what the town might think about having to decide this, about having a jury of some Waco residents having to decide this. They said that, you know, they felt they could be objective, but they frankly were tired of having to hear the story again and again. Anyone who is from here will tell you that if they visit another part of the country, when you say Waco, people immediately think of those awful images they saw at noon on April 19th, 1993. They think religious nuts. They think government confrontation. And so people here are simply a little tired of the subject. What's interesting is this is a very high-profile case. You would expect a contingent of local courtroom observers, people who would want to come to watch the theater of such a high-profile trial. There are very, very few local residents who have come in. Now, the courtroom was very full yesterday, but even at points where there were seats available, you didn't see many local people, outside a couple of law professors from the local university, which is Baylor University. I think people, frankly, are just waiting and hoping, you know, that this may finally close a chapter for them, because this is a story that they have gone over again and again and again. Even before this trial, there had been a number of other civil cases and civil trials in Waco arising from the standoff. And so even a courtroom display of evidence regarding the Davidian case is something that they've seen many times before.
Lee Hancock, I want to thank you very much for joining us again, the breaking reporter with the Dallas Morning News, who has covered Waco from the beginning. If people want to read your pieces on the Dallas Morning News website, where can they go?
It's at www.dallasnews.com.
Thanks for being with us. Lee Hancock standing outside the courtroom in Waco, Texas, as she covers these opening days of the trial. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return from our break, we're going to continue to look at this 11th hour, this day before the planned execution of Shaka Sankofa Gary Graham, where the case stands now. And we'll talk about the latest developments in the case. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The Texas president pro tem of the Texas Senate has asked the Board of Pardons and Paroles in the state to hold a rare public hearing on the fate of death row prisoner Gary Graham. He's scheduled to be executed tomorrow, 6 p.m. Texas time. In a letter obtained by the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, State Senator Rodney Ellis wrote, "Serious concerns have been raised about the Gary Graham case." As president pro tem of the Texas Senate, Ellis serves as the state's top executive when the governor and lieutenant governor are out of state. In an unusual move, the chair of the board has postponed the deadline for the vote until noon tomorrow. That's 6 hours before Graham is set to die. Typically, members of the parole board individually review a case, then vote by fax or telephone without group deliberation. Texas Governor George Bush, who would like to be president at the end of this year, at the beginning of next, has publicly attempted to make the Board of Pardons and Parole the focus of who will decide Gary Graham's fate, but all of the board's members are Bush appointees. Meanwhile, yesterday, Gary Graham was visited by the Reverend Jesse Jackson. He's among those calling for Bush to spare Graham's life. Jackson met with Graham for about an hour, and afterward, he described him as hopeful and criticized the governor.
America's principles are on trial today. Governor Bush wants to wash his hands and step away from responsibility.
Reverend Jesse Jackson, along with many others who have gathered in Houston and headed to Huntsville for this last period before Gary Graham is slated to die. We're joined on the telephone right now by by Robert Warden, who is executive director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at the Northwestern University School of Law, and also Tanya McClary, who is attorney and program director for the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Very briefly, Robert Warden, if you can start off by giving us a nutshell description of Gary Graham Shaka Sankofa's case and why so many are calling for a reprieve.
In 1981, based solely on the testimony of a single eyewitness. There are two other eyewitnesses that the jury did not hear from who are absolutely certain in their minds that Gary Graham was not the person who committed the crime for which Gary has been sentenced to death. That is the crux of it. Given the unreliability of eyewitness testimony, and particularly with the suggestive procedures used by the police in this case, there is a high probability that an error was made by the witness. Therefore, we think this is simply an inappropriate case for execution.
Tanya McClary, you met with Gary Graham yesterday. How are his spirits?
His spirits are very strong. He is actually really believing that we, the people, will be able to halt this execution. Is actually, you know, making plans for things that he wants to do after the 22nd.
Are a lot of reporters getting in to see Gary Graham? We're seeing more corporate news coverage of this case than I've ever seen of a death penalty case, except perhaps in the case of Carla Faye Tucker.
It indeed has attracted a lot of public attention, and virtually every television network has been in to see Gary and interview him in recent days.
Robert Warden, your organization, the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University School of Law, why has it gotten so deeply involved in this case? Larry Marshall was just down in Houston. Why this case in particular?
Well, we have never executed anybody in this country based on, or not since 1970, not since the mid-70s when capital punishment was restored, based on such flimsy evidence that is contradicted like this. We have become involved in this case simply because it is just the very notion that we would even consider executing somebody based on the uncertainty of this evidence is so appalling. We have, since the advent of DNA technology, and of course DNA technology is not available in this case, there is no DNA to test, but 67 people in America have been exonerated after having been convicted of crimes they did not commit based on DNA. Of those 67, 51 had been identified by eyewitnesses. So that gives you some idea. That's like 75%. And it gives you some general idea of the general unreliability of eyewitness testimony and why we think it is so appalling that we would be even contemplating executing somebody based on this evidence.
Tanya McClary, can you describe right now what is the process from now until the time and date set to die, which is June 22nd, Thursday, 6 o'clock Texas time? What has to happen? And these latest developments of the news of a letter of the Texas State Senate President Pro Tem calling for the Board of Pardons and Paroles to have an actual public hearing on his case.
I mean, I think what has to happen right now is that, you know, we really have to appeal to Governor Bush's compassionate side. I mean, he has stated clearly in many public statements that he feels that the system in Texas is working and that when he considers a death penalty case to do any kind of relief on, that it would be a case where there's a question about the person's guilt or innocence or whether there's a question about the person having full access to the courts. I mean, I think that what we have to do at this time is let Governor Bush know that, you know, Mr. Graham's case falls into both of those categories. He had a two-day trial. It took them one day to find him guilty and another day to sentence him to death, a trial in which no witnesses were called on his behalf and where the other crime scene witnesses who say vehemently that it wasn't him were never called. And so I think that if Mr. Bush were to hear that, he would know clearly that Mr. Graham did not have full access to the courts. And also the issue of whether or not he's guilty or innocent is very clearly in question here. And so in terms of his own two categories for consideration of any type of clemency or reprieve or anything like that, Mr. Graham's case definitely falls into those two categories. So I think right now people around the nation still need to make that message very clear to him that this is definitely a case that fits into his own criteria for relief.
Do you have the phone numbers for the governor?
The phone numbers for the governor, I can give those to you in just a second.
Okay, we'll go to that in a minute. Tanya McClary, who just met with Gary Graham, now known as Shaka Sankofa, on death row yesterday. Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jesse Jackson, also met with him. We're on the phone as well with Will Harrell, who's executive director of the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union of Texas. In terms of the Senate President Pro Tem calling for the Board of Pardons and Paroles to have a meeting, can you describe how this board operates?
In great mysterious nature, and it's something that really I'm glad that you're calling attention to it. No one really knows, quite frankly. There are 18 members who are all appointed by the governor, in this case George Bush. Not a single criminal defense lawyer or abolitionist type is on the of those 18, as you would suspect. They're spread around the state, and they do not meet in person and often don't even have a conference call to decide matters of life and death. However, in this case, they are scheduled to meet at noon tomorrow, which is extraordinary and I think a very positive sign that something might finally happen in this case. In fact, there's a leak in the Dallas newspaper today of one of the members who went nameless, anonymous, one of the members of the board who has said that they're coming together because they have real concerns about innocence and the lack of a fair trial in this case. So I have great hope that this board for once is going to come together and actually meet and do the right thing.
I was talking about the national mainstream media paying a great deal of attention to this case right now, with pieces almost every day, both on television and also in the front pages and the editorial pages of the papers. Will Harrell, what about the main Texas newspapers?
Oh, it's been heavily covered in the newspapers today. In fact, as of yesterday, all three of the four major metropolitan area newspapers have come out. Asking,
which papers?
That would be the Austin American Statesman, the Dallas Morning News, and the San Antonio Express have all called for a pardon in this case. The Houston Chronicle, which is probably the largest distribution paper and decidedly right-wing, came out today saying that maybe or maybe not, but there's some real question about question of innocence in this case. So they almost took the opposite view in this case, but that was to be expected.
Robert Warden of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University School of Law. What does it mean when people say in Texas that innocence can be irrelevant in some cases?
Well, I think that there's probably no question that you're better off to be wealthy and guilty than you are to be poor and innocent in the state of Texas. The court-appointed system of counsel for capital cases in Texas is simply appalling. In most states in the North, like here in Illinois and in New York, there are excellent public defender systems that provide able representation at the beginning. There's nothing like that in Texas. Gary Graham's trial lawyer, Ronald Mock, is responsible for having 12 clients on death row, five of whom have been executed. And his performance in this case was simply so far below standards that it's just amazing. For instance, the jury heard that the victim was killed with a .22 caliber pistol and that Gary Graham was arrested with a .22 caliber pistol, but Mr. Mock failed to introduce the fact that ballistics had shown that that was not the murder weapon. So that's the standard that we're talking about here.
There has been a level of activism around the country also in this case that we've seen perhaps only in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal and death row in Pennsylvania. On Monday night, there were protests where George Bush was making a campaign stop in Palo Alto as people stood up and called for a reprieve for Gary Graham. And in New York yesterday, outside Republican headquarters, there was another protest. We're joined on the phone right now by Larry Holmes, who is a well-known activist in New York. Can you tell us what happened there? I understand there were a number of arrests as well.
A delegation from the demonstration the other night went into the New York State Republican Party committee offices, and we asked the staff there to get some of the officials of the New York State Republican Party on the phone and urge them to contact Governor Bush and urge him to stop the execution of an innocent man. We negotiated with them for a while. They said they would set up a meeting with some middle echelon officials with us if we agreed to leave the office. Our reply to that was, why couldn't they get those people in today? And we insisted on staying until they contacted people like Governor Pataki and the mayor and the head of the state party, William Powers. Eventually, the police were brought in and we were arrested and taken out. But we're still trying to do whatever we can to keep the pressure on from New York. I know there's another demonstration tonight at 5 at the Roosevelt Hotel, which may turn into an all-night vigil for people who can come to that. And by the way, I think that a fundraising affair for Governor Bush last night in L.A. Also had some protesters inside getting up and raising placards and asking the governor to stop the execution, in addition to what you reported on earlier at the fundraiser in Palo Alto. So we've got to keep the pressure on. I think this is the most important struggle. You know, if we're thinking about saving Mumir, if we're thinking about stopping the Texas death machine, then we've all got to give 100% right now. And, the clock's ticking.
I'm sorry that we don't have a representative of the Attorney General of Texas on. We tried to get them on, and they refused. But Tanya McCleary, maybe for a moment you can step into the head of George Bush. What does he have to gain right now by executing Shaka Sankofa? He could hardly be accused of being soft on the death penalty. He has presided over more executions than any governor in the history of the United States. Interestingly enough, in the state of Florida yesterday, where his brother presides as governor, there was just a reprieve for a man on death row 10 minutes before he was slated to get the chemicals pumped into his arms. The needles were already in his arms. What does George Bush gain here?
I mean, to be honest with you, I think we're all baffled at this point, and I think no one understands what he has to gain. I think at this point in time, with this much flimsy evidence, with people like the Center for Wrongful Conviction saying that this is one of the thinnest cases that they've ever seen of all the people that have been executed, the only thing he has to gain here is to say that it looks like I'm not going to bow to pressure. I mean, anybody that looks at this case, I mean, it's a win-win situation for him. If he urges the Board of Pardons and Parole to do something, then he really does show that he is this compassionate man that he says. And he also, you know, it fits the two criteria that he has laid out to the public time and time again. And so I think everyone's really baffled. For him to just go ahead and allow this execution to take place, the only thing that it looks like is that he says that I'm not going to bow to pressure. Because if he really looked at the case, really took the time to examine it and have his cabinet people examine it, I don't know how in good conscience he cannot say that this is definitely a case where the evidence needs to be heard, or at the very minimum, there needs to be some kind of hearing by the Board of Pardons and Parole.
Will Harrell, head of the Texas ACLU, can you talk about the recent Supreme Court decision that didn't involve Gary Graham, Shaka Sankofa, but did involve the case of Victor Hugo Saldano?
Oh, yes, the Saldano case. It does have implications in the Gary Graham case. I mean, the Saldano case is where the Supreme Court reversed the Texas death penalty case and sent it back to be retried. It wasn't a question of innocence or guilt, but the problem was the prosecutor put forward an expert witness, or so-called expert witness, who testified that the defendant was more likely than not to commit further violent crimes because he was Latino male, and his evidence of showing that this proves propensity to commit violent crimes was by merely pointing to the overrepresentation of Latino and African-American males in the prison system, which is, you know, pretty much our point, those of us who are out here trying to fight racial profiling and racially biased criminal justice systems. So that was reversed, and the Attorney General then announced that there were 8 other cases that were just like that, that they were investigating, and already 4 of those have been thrown out by the, you know, according to a motion made by the defense attorneys supported by the Attorney General's office. But it does indeed have implications in the Gary Graham case. Gary Graham is from Harris County, which is in Houston, and 78% of people on death row in Texas are black males from that county, or 73%, I believe. So there's a disproportionate racial factor in the sentence of death, and not only when an expert witness says because of the propensity of a person to commit crimes on the basis of race, but simply who is over-policed, who is over-sentenced, who is underrepresented in court are generally people of color.
For a moment, I want to break to hear Gary Graham's voice himself. He has, as is often the case now in issues of police brutality and in case of death row, his voice has been recorded and put on CD, and this is one of those cases.
Let the evidence be heard.
I want you to know that I love each and every one of you sisters and brothers in the community, and I truly hope that somewhere in your hearts you have love for me. because life has taught me that our destiny as well is tied together, and whatever affects one of us affects all of us, and none of us are free until all of our sisters and brothers are free from national oppression, exploitation, institutionalized discrimination, and systematic injustice. Brothers and sisters, it is precisely because my plight has become a symbol of injustice that the enemies of our people are determined to legally lynch and execute me for political reasons. Just like in Semi Valley, the judiciary in Texas is unwilling and incapable of protecting victims of racism who find themselves seeking justice from the courts. The death penalty is tied to a long and ugly history of racism in the United States. The death penalty emerged out of the history of slavery in this country, and it is a remnant of racially biased policies. The death penalty devalues black life in every regard, and it is a critical issue of genocidal proportion. It is imperative that socially conscious people with a voice look at this struggle to outlaw legalized murder like the struggle to outlaw slavery. I believe that if more entertainers and artists, and particularly young rap artists, would begin spotlighting this horrendous and racist practice in their artistry, it would advance the struggle for social justice and human rights and help to end this systematic injustice.
That is Gary Graham, Shaka Sankofa, recorded recently on death row. As we talk about his case, we are a day away from his slated execution. That CD, Let the Evidence Be Heard. Again, I would like to, as we were talking, the producers were able to get the phone numbers and the fax numbers in this case, however you feel about it, to let your views be heard. George Bush's phone number is 512-463-2000, the governor of Texas, who can ultimately decide this case, whether Gary Graham will die tomorrow night, 6 p.m. Texas time, 512-463-2000. Fax number, 512-463-1849. That's 512-463-1849. And the number of the Texas Parole Board is 512-406-5852. That's 512-406-5852. Again, they may well be meeting for the first time in public in many, many years to decide the case of Gary Graham, Shaka Sankofa. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, last comments from our guests, and we are then going to look at a precedent-setting case of the Supreme Court on school prayer. Will Harrell will stay with us of the Texas ACLU because they were deeply involved in the case. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we wrap up on this 11th hour, this day before the moment that Gary Graham, Shaka Sankofa, is slated to die, a number of people have gone down to Texas. Tanya McClary, you're with the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Who is there now? There have been news conferences almost every day.
Exactly. Who's here now is Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. He's also been joined by Bianca Jagger. We're expecting Reverend Herbert Daltrey from New York, as well as Reverend Al Sharpton, and the list continues to grow. We are thinking that rapper and activist Chuck D is also heading down at this time, and so the list is just continuing to grow. We're getting calls from from celebrities that have been working on Gary's case for years, either if they're physically not coming, calling to give their support. And we've gotten phone calls from Ed Asner. We've gotten phone calls from actor Danny Glover, from actor Ozzie Davis, actress Ruby Dee, and others who physically cannot make it here but are definitely calling to express their concern and their well wishes for Shaka.
This is what Bianca Jagger, the human rights activist, had to say yesterday.
Governor Bush has said that he has never convicted, he has never, that his state has never executed anyone that was innocent. In this case, the governor will be executing someone that is innocent.
And that Bianca Jagger. Finally, Robert Warden of the National Center on Wrongful Convictions. Your last comment.
Well, I think that what we recommend is that the governor grant a conditional pardon in this case, under which Gary Graham would agree to waive his double jeopardy protections and face retrial if the Harris County authorities wish to proceed with a retrial. This is the only way that these witnesses, exculpatory witnesses, can be heard and the credibility of their testimony can be gauged. It's never been done, and it should be done.
And finally, Will Harrell, we're going to move on right now. I want to thank Tanya McClary and Robert Warden for joining us. Both have been very involved with the Gary Graham Shaka Sankofa case, the phone number of George Bush's office. The governor of Texas in Austin is 512-463-2000. That's 512-463-2000. Will Harrell, the Texas ACLU, you've been involved in a number of death penalty cases, but you've also been involved in the Supreme Court's decision around school prayer. In a crushing defeat for school prayer supporters, the Supreme Court this week reaffirmed that praying in public schools must be private. By a 6-3 vote, the court barred officials from letting students lead stadium crowds in prayer before football games. The court's sweeping language in the Texas case could extend far beyond school sports events, eventually affecting graduation ceremonies, moments of silence, and more. The ruling said a school district's policy of allowing such student-led prayers violates the constitutionally required separation of government and religion. How did this particular case wind up in the Supreme Court?
Well, it wound up in the Supreme Court because it was a premeditated campaign of the religious right. The Rutherford Institute and the Center, one of the other spinoff religious right think tanks and legal operations. When we got this case in 1994, it was filed in 95. At that time, we began discussing the situation with the superintendent of the Santa Fe Independent School District, who indicated to us that, you know, he didn't really want to get mixed up in court and wanted to resolve the problem. And the law was pretty clear that this was a state endorsement of religion or school-sponsored prayer, despite the way that it looked on the face of the policy. It looked secular, but it was not. But these people got involved and sort of provoked a case that went through the court system, and we won all the way and finally ended up in the Supreme Court. And to much to their chagrin, we ended up with the most solid and definitive decision on church-state separation with where schools are concerned that we've had in 30 years. We're very pleased with the way the court came out on this case, but not surprised.
So where do you think it goes from here, and is the Supreme Court making other rulings on similar cases?
Well, I think this case just very much says very clearly that wherever the state is involved, and in these cases, the school, if the school is organizing, promoting, or has some level of control over an event, then prayer is prohibited. And it's just that clear. And though this case involves specifically prayer before a football game, it clearly has ramifications in all other settings, including the graduation context.
Can you talk about the particular people who were involved with this original case?
Yes, because that's very important. We represented an anonymous family that practices, are real churchgoers who are Catholic, and another who is Mormon, who to this day cannot release their name because of the danger associated with, you know, being the Judah in the flock, actually calling the question on religion. They were offended because a number of things were happening, not just school prayers at a football game, but the teachers were giving out Gideon Bibles. A teacher was, had chastised one of the non-Christian students for being non-Christian for his parents' beliefs. Teachers were organizing Christian revivals off campus and not inviting the non-Christian students to do it. I mean, that's the environment. And after we filed the case, we did so anonymously to protect these people from harassment, the school began to investigate who the plaintiffs were. And ultimately, we had to go back into court and get an order against school districts to stop. And the court said that if they continued, there'd be serious sanctions, including criminal liability. After we filed the case, some kids gathered around a Jewish kid and taunted, Hitler was wrong, Hitler missed one, Hitler was wrong, Hitler should have gotten you. That's the kind of environment that we're talking about.
And then tell us about the 6-3 vote. Who voted against?
Oh, well, naturally, Rehnquist, who wrote the dissenting opinion, and he was joined, of course, as always, by Scalia and Thomas. But what's different about this case is, number one, it's very solid and far-reaching in its language. The majority was written by Stevens. But often in church-state cases, you'll have a majority, a bare majority decision with maybe two or three concurrences, and all read together don't make sense. In this case, you've got a majority and a slight minority in the dissent. And so it's very clear and really settles the question.
I want to ask you a final question before we wrap up, Will Harrell, because you deal with a lot of Texas issues as executive director of the ACLU. We talked about Gary Graham Shaka Sankofa's case. We've now talked about this school prayer case. I wanted to talk about Bush politics in Texas and basically how he's doing by your report card and the sentiment around him now, especially as the Shaka Sankofa Gary Graham case swirls.
Well, that's a really complicated matter. I am from Texas, but I've been exiled for 13 years and just came back from New York, actually, and I was based at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I'm just back, and I'm trying to get a handle on this, and I think Tanya said it right. I mean, there's a certain level of defensiveness here, and I think what George Bush is having right now is two things. Number one, it's this sort of a Texas independence, almost arrogance, that when you involve northern states or by goodness, foreign states criticizing actions here, Texans unify and stand behind their leader, in this case being George Bush. And also George Bush has this typical Tejano Machista complex that, he's just going to stand strong no matter what, right or wrong. Standing strong is what it's about in the Machista culture of Texas. There's some editorials today saying, maybe there is doubt or not, but by God, we got to stand by our death penalty. And Texans are really proud. I mean, remember not long ago, there was even the Democrats who were running for office. By the way, death penalty is supported by 88% of Republicans and 65% of Democrats, which is a much higher rate than what is national. And back in the last governor's race before Bush came in, between Ann Richards and another Democrat during the Democratic convention, I mean, there was a real competition between who had presided over more executions. This is a real executioner state, and I don't see much of a change coming about. But I do think that there is an upsurge in, number one, embarrassment, and number two, so much focus has been put on Gary Graham's case that people are beginning to question the system, not the death penalty and as a philosophical matter, but the system and how it functions.
Well, Will Harrell, I want to thank you very much for being with us from the Texas ACLU Executive Director. And as we wrap up the program, we wanted to go quickly to a report that has just been released, actually two reports. One is an unprecedented report from the World Health Organization that says that the U.S. healthcare system costs more than any other in the world on a per capita basis, but ranks only 37th in terms of quality of care. And the other is a report that has been released by Families USA, which is based in Washington, about how a million low-income parents have lost their Medicaid coverage since the overhauling of the nation's welfare programs in 1996. And we turn now to Ron Pollack, who's executive director of Families USA. Can you describe your findings?
Sure, and thank you for inviting me. The report shows that when people move from welfare to work, what has happened is they wind up in jobs that are entry-level jobs that don't provide health care coverage, and in the process, they're losing their Medicaid coverage. And so the reward for doing the right thing is that people become uninsured. Well, there are two aspects to it that are very important. First, a number of states have been terminating people from Medicaid improperly. They haven't informed people that when they move from welfare to work, that they may still be eligible for Medicaid if their income levels are very low. And in any event, they're supposed to receive transition Medicaid assistance to tide them over as they transition to jobs. So one problem is that the states are poorly administering the relationship between welfare reform and Medicaid. The second problem is that the states have dreadfully low income eligibility standards for people who are taking jobs. In two-thirds of the states in the United States, if you work at the minimum wage, $5.15 an hour, you are considered to have too much income to qualify for Medicaid as a parent if you work full-time. In Texas, for example, if you work more than 18 hours a week, less than half-time at the minimum wage, you're considered to have too much income to qualify for Medicaid.
Do you think that your findings tie into this World Health Organization report talking about U.S. health care and ranking it as only 37th in terms of quality of care in the world?
Sure. We have the best of all worlds and the worst of all worlds. We provide excellent care for people who have good health insurance, but we do a really poor job dealing with tens of millions of people who are simply uninsured. Today in America, we've got 44.3 million Americans who are uninsured. This is the only country in the Western world that experiences this kind of a problem. And what is extraordinary is that these folks who are uninsured really suffer serious consequences. If there is a pain in a part of the body or the onset of an illness, people defer getting care, and often the health situation gets worse and worse, and sometimes it actually can lead to very extreme circumstances. So we treat people very well who are well insured and who have a lot of money, but for tens of millions of Americans, particularly low-wage working Americans, we provide very inadequate care.
And the other report, the World Health Organization report, found that for some people, for some Native Americans in certain counties of the United States, they can expect to only live to 50 years of age. I want to thank you very much, Ron Pollack, for being with us of Families USA. If people want to see your report, where can they go on the web?
Go to our website at www.familiesusa.org, and Families USA has no spacing or capitalization or punctuation. It's www.familiesusa.org.
Thank you. And that does it for today's program. Again, if you want to reach George Bush and let him know how you feel about the Gary Graham case, his number 512-463-2000. His fax 512-463-1849. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Special thanks to Sharan Harper, Hapti Selassie, and Rosalie Hoffman. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!